Okay, Boomer. Valentine's Day's coming. I told my sons they might not want to go through the cattle call of Valentine's Day with their girlfriends, where some servers are exhausted and they throw the creme brulee at you, and everyone can't get a table, and there's a lot of sweating and nervousness. But that's part of being young. Always sweating, always nervous. That little pit in your stomach. Does she really like me? Does she not like me? Does he like me? It's romance, man. It's great. But you know what? Here's a romantic thing I offered to them, and they totally rejected it. I said, why don't you invite your girlfriend to your place? Pour out a nice glass of Prosecco. Have a long stem rose. Just one. Don't do a dozen roses. It's extravagant. And give her a blindfold to put on. Not one of those 50 Shades of Grey blindfolds. I mean, something that you could see through. That's not, you know, not aggressive. And then after she has her Prosecco, lead her into the kitchen. Sit her on a stool. Put on some music, whatever her favorite music is. I mean, if you want to go old school, you put on Frank Sinatra. But what 24-year-old's going to do that? You know, I don't know what you're going to put on. Back in my day, I would have put on Led Zeppelin, but, you know, Black Dog might not have been the right mood setter. Anyway, so you sit her down on the stool in the well-lighted kitchen, and then you start talking to her, and you start making spaghetti carbonara without the cream. Boil the spaghetti, 9 minutes, make it nice, salty. Don't throw in 1 teaspoon of salt, because no cook does that. Throw in a whole hoofta of salt, because that's what you have to do. And don't cook it for 20 minutes. Cook it for 9. Take it out, put it in a bowl. In a pan, onions, bacon, render it. When the bacon is rendered, but before it's really crisp, or pancetta or whatever, put in some chicken stock. Add some frozen peas. Stir that up. And then take that hot mixture, take your pasta, put the pasta in a bowl, take that stuff, put it in the bowl with the pasta, add 3 or 4 eggs, and use the heat of the pasta to cook the eggs and mix everything up. Add cheese, a nice glass of wine, and bring her to the table, set it for her. Treat her like a lady with great respect. Because romance is it's just a dance. It's a dance. It's not anything else. That's why girls like to dance. That's why guys like me say, I can't dance. That's why we're not romantic. And I'm not romantic. What do I know about romance? Romance is the topic of the heart. But politics is the topic of the mind. And it's all about who gets what, when, where, how, and how much. You're going to find virtue in politics? Really? You're going to look for the virtuous person? My Democratic liberal friends convinced me you could not find virtue back in 1998. They told me virtue has no business. It's not about character. It's not about virtue. It's about policy. Okay, fine. I went to the re-education camp. I'm re-educated. And always in this search for education and to learn more, we talk to important people. Today, we're going to be talking to one of my favorite writers, David Harsanyi of National Review. He also writes for the New York Post. He's written books. He used to write for The Federalist, another great site I go to. We're going to talk to him about fact-checking, and fact-checking in the time of Trump, because that became the phenomenon, fact-checking. You know, there was no fact-checking when Obama was pulling the sword out of the stone of City Hall and became king, you know, the warrior king that we all loved. The one who would heal us just by touching us. All he had to do was touch us, and we were healed of everything. Now we have a new thing called fact-checking, and it's all supposed to be impartial, and David Harsanyi will explain. We also have some big news to break. The Chicago Tribune now has one of your favorite guest hosts on the Chicago Way, the one who could sing, and we'll talk about her, editor-in-chief of the editorial board. And Jeff Carlin is here, executive producer of the Rokan Show on WGN. And me, I'm John Cass, nationally syndicated columnist. I hate to say that, but who, if you don't toot your own horn, who will? But the main thing, husband, father, columnist for the Chicago Tribune, member of its great editorial board. And you know where you are? Between the fact checkers and the impeachment and Trump climbing on that hill of Schiff to Crow and making spaghetti carbonara, you're on the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
As I told you, our special guest is David Harsanyi, the senior writer at the National Review. He writes a column also for the New York Post. He's formerly of the Federalist, and I search him on Google every day. I look for his tweets. I look for his column. It's a secret to all of you, but I'd like to tell you who I read so you can get a sense of where I'm coming from, even if you didn't know already. And I really like David's stuff. He is the author of First Freedom, a book, A Ride Through America's Enduring History with a Gun. He's written a book called The People Have Spoken and They Are Wrong, The Case Against Democracy, which I would add is the democracy means rule of the mob, and Obama's Four Horsemen, Disasters Unleashed by Obama's Reelection. I'm pleased to welcome to the Chicago Way writer I most respect, David Harsanyi.
Wow, hello. I appreciate those kind words. Thank you so much.
Did I sound like a radio personality doing the intro?
Yes, I always appreciate it. It puffs me up.
Yes, that's important. You got to puff people, and you're not a politician, so we don't have to puff you up and then prick you with a pin.
That's correct.
So,
ego boosting.
Recently, you've written a column about fact checking, and I've always been infuriated by people, including editors at my place, that run fact checks as if these are dispassionate observers of truth.
Right.
And the headline was particularly revealing. What was it again about the janissaries?
Yeah, that they were janissaries. Fact checkers were janissaries for the Obama legacy, and that was particularly about the State of the Union fact checks.
Right. You deconstructed the Washington Post fact check. I think we used to run their stuff. I don't know if we do anymore. Anytime I see anything from the Washington Post, I think of Jennifer Rubin screaming in a room by herself, and I'd rather not look at it. Your point being that fact checkers are themselves human and therefore come with their own bias and prejudices.
Right. Every writer has their own biases and prejudices, and just find the whole fact-checking industry misleading. Because, first of all, even if they were just checking facts and correcting facts, you could still be biased in the sense of how, you know, the facts you check, you know, and whose facts you're checking and things like that. But worse than that, you know, there's just this underlying nitpicky bias that, you know, that is deployed for certain people and not for others, you know. So everything Trump says, is nitpicked. And that would be fine by me, honestly, if you did it both ways for both sides. And that, you know, but we know that there was no real fact-checking when Obama was president in most of these sort of publications. So, but more than that now, lately I've noticed that the fact-checkers, because there is good news, especially on the economy, are fact-checking in a way that now they say things like, and I might not get the wording exactly correct, but it says like, yes, the words that Donald Trump said were correct, but, and then they go into two, you know, graphs of explaining how, you know, what Donald Trump, you know, concludes from those correct facts are wrong. Well, that's, now you're just a columnist, and that's fine. I'm a columnist. You're making political arguments. That's not fact-checking. And so I think it's important to point that out to people as much as I can.
And David, I love that, because Regina and I were just talking about this, you know, referencing your column as we were prepping for this interview. And that's the thing that kills me. I'd be okay if it was just a list of, hey, you know, the whoever has said XYZ, but in reality, XYZ is not at all true. But it's the idea, well, that's true, but that kills me every time you see it.
But, and another thing they did that made me, I laughed when I read it, was they say, you know, I forgot what Trump said exactly, energy production is at the highest level ever. And they say, yeah, but really, it was also higher under Obama. Well, yeah, I guess that's true. But Obama did everything he could to make it not be high. So you're taking credit away from Donald Trump on gas and giving it to someone who, and oil, and giving it to someone who actually worked over and over again to try to inhibit production, not expand it. So technically, yes, those are fact checks, but I mean, they're also opinions, right? So I think that's how we need to view it.
Yeah. And they completely glossing over, because I remember that exact fact check where it was like, you know, Trump says, oh, we're now independent, an oil independency. Okay, sure, we've been oil independent for a while, get it. But the Obama claim is insane, because they say, because Obama did it. Well, it was all holdover from the Bush era, which, guess what? He was a Texas guy.
Right.
No joke that oil production skyrocketed under his and held over.
Yeah, exactly. And using that kind of metric for the economy, we could go back to the 1700s. I mean, when you look at a GDP growth overall, you know, there are little bumps in the road, but it's just a spiking line, you know, so every president gets credit falsely. I mean, I don't think presidents are really creating all these jobs, but if you're going to do it for one, I think we have to allow it for the other. And that's been one of my big complaints during the Trump administration, is that there's a whole new set of rules we use for him because he's kind of, you know, not kind of, he is unique in how he speaks, etc.
Well, he gets up on that hill of Schiff and begins to crow, and that infuriates many people, especially now after he defeated the Democratic impeachment plan. Now, janissaries, I know what they are, although after tweeting your column out, I was accused of not knowing what they are, which made me laugh. Janissaries were the special forces of the Ottoman Turk. They were the firstborn of Greeks taken from their families and turned into the elite special forces to repress, suppress, and destroy or keep in line all these meddlesome Christians and Muslims that that they didn't like or they wanted to keep in. How does that apply politically to the article you wrote and to this phenomenon of, because it seems to me it was just perfect. I just loved it.
I want to admit that it was accidentally perfect, I think. It's just kind of a, like, you know, rhetorical flourish, and that I just was thinking about because I had actually was reading, I'd been read something on the Ottoman Empire. But it kind of worked, and the more I think about it, I think it works better, especially since the Janissary sort of became weaker and weaker as time went on and others modernized. So, but yeah, I mean, I think the media has this sort of, its disposition and its immediate reaction, almost perfunctorily, is to defend the Obama administration. And it does that. And let's be honest, Donald Trump, I think his State of the Union was more overtly political in that he pointed to the Obama administration over and over again, I think pretty fairly, for having failed to do a bunch of stuff that it promised. So I think that their instinct, and they're mostly insulted by the idea that Donald Trump is achieving things that they could not, and that Obama could not, who is the, you know, hero of many of these people. So I don't know. I thought maybe Swiss Guard or something like that, but then I thought janissaries work better.
You're free to use Kemalists to talk about
like
the deep state. I offered it to Molly and to Kim Strassel, and I give it to you as well. Kemalists.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Because writers do trade, you know, we just adapt.
Yeah, now, I want people to pick up my, you know, my ideas and run with them. I want to. So
the The point you, the deeper point I think you make here, perhaps I'm wrong, is that the fact checkers, as representative of journalism today, are bound and determined to protect Obama's legacy and attack or criticize Trump. And that's fine, as you say, if you're writing a column, have at it, but it's offered as fact rather than opinion. And I wonder what it says about the state of journalism, in which editors and people, you know, like I'll write something in my column and an editor will say, well, the PolitiFact said, you know, as if that's somehow an arbiter to me. Like I try to restrain my laughter, but you hear that all the time. And I'm wondering, after this period, after the Trumpian period, whether it lasts for another term or perhaps he just actually fulfills their fantasy and takes over the government and rules as king, will we ever go back to another, to that other time in journalism where at least we had the pretense of not having an entire culture be partisan?
I don't know that we can ever really go back. Honestly, I think Trump sort of blew all that up. But, you know, I think, yeah, I worked in a newspaper for many years. I think that it, you know, that bias has always been there, but now people feel freer to show it because Trump is so evil, etc. Even though, you know, I mean, Bush was so evil too for many of them as well. It's not much of a change, but I think the pushback is the change. The way Trump acts is a change. The kind of bravery, and I don't always like what he says, you know, about that, but about journalism. But I do think that it makes a lot of people. Instills a lot of courage into people who normally wouldn't have pushed back as hard. I think that's important. I wish journalism was healthier, but I don't think so. I think it's pretty much corrupt, especially the larger institutions are political organizations. And the fact-checking is a perfect example. And don't get me wrong, occasionally there are good fact-checks, and I learn things from fact-checkers, but I just view them as columnists like anyone else. The problem is, you just mentioned, people like to, like, go on and say, oh my gosh, you know, Trump has lied 12,324 times. It's right here, you know, says the Washington Post fact checker. Well, it doesn't work that way. And CNN has fact checkers that are even worse. I mean, much worse. It's just the nitpicky nature of it where they take Trump's jokes and pretend he's, you know, lying, or, you know, I'm from Queens, New York. That's where I was born, where Trump's from, or the way Trump talks that they don't really understand, hyperbole he uses, and they pretend that he's, you know, relaying facts and act as if, you know, he's just this liar. When you hear him speak, you realize he's just, it's just the way he talks and his exaggerations.
They put 3 years of Democratic planning into a comment he made where he said, please, Putin, reveal Hillary's emails that she's hidden. And that became, it just,
yeah,
it's just ridiculous. It was embarrassing. It's been, yeah. It's been embarrassing to see my colleagues grab onto that as if it were like some sort of secret.
Yeah,
you know,
that,
like,
that was the code. I thought that was the signal.
Yeah, right.
Are they overtaking?
You know what he should have done? He should have leaned over quietly and whispered, I'll have more flexibility. Tell Vladimir after.
If you are a spy for since 1980s, as Jonathan Chait says in the New York magazine, and you're an asset for Russia, do you need to go on television and ask them, or wouldn't you just pick up the phone and call them? It doesn't make sense. I mean, the whole Russian thing was a disaster for this country. I just mean that it was a disaster for the country because of the political implications of, you know, Donald Trump's presidency. I mean that a bunch of Democrats, like 60-something percent of them, don't think that Russia is changing votes, that Russia is putting too much salt in their, you know, diet or whatever. I mean, really, we've become a nation of a that wholly believes a gigantic conspiracy theory that is just ridiculous.
It's almost as if Putin could have written it himself. You know, that's what I've always thought. I always think that
they've done more damage than Putin to the veracity of our elections, the way people think about them. I think they've done more damage.
When you were at the Federalist, you wrote a series of pieces on with Molly Hemingway, who's also been on this program, on the impeachment and on the Russia collusion, the explosion of the Russia collusion theory. And I'm wondering, I've wondered this, and I've referenced Matt Taibbi and Glenn Greenwald at The Intercept, who've been targeting or had targeted media coverage of it. I'm wondering, when will media, the Democratic media complex, as I call them, when will they, even though I guess I'm part of it, mainstream, when will they acknowledge or expose all the deep staters or the administrative staters or the Kamalists, as I like to say, who lied to them, repeatedly and manipulated them into creating that situation that you're talking about? Will that ever happen?
I mean, we might learn about it at some point, but I don't think it's ever going to be sort of proactively or actively sought out by people in mainstream news. I mean, the story that the presidential candidate was spied on using evidence that was basically cooked up by the other party is a massive story. I mean, using the FBI and intelligence agencies, it's just a massive story. In any other time, if the reverse had happened, it would be Watergate times 10 for the media, but yet it's still just completely ignored. And I was thinking, there's this story out now that Fox News, someone got him found, or someone leaked a memo where Fox News is talking about Rudy and how he's misleading on Ukraine and stuff like that. The important part of that is I've read now 5 major stories on that in various magazines and publications, but yet I still don't know how CNN got 5 stories about the Russia collusion thing completely wrong from multiple sources. No one's even interested in that, but a 1 Fox memo where someone dings Rudy Giuliani, I have to read about it over and over again. It's just incredible to me that there aren't liberals out there who are ideological and care, hate Trump, but also care about the truth enough to figure this stuff out or to write about it. And there are very few of those people around.
So what is the effect of that?
Well, I mean, you have major, gigantic organizations with tons of money that basically are just political, basically giant PACs who work against one party. And the other party has the president, but very few, doesn't have the money to really push back as far as, having their own organizations. There are very few. There's the Wall Street Journal editorial page, there's some magazines, there's some columnists, but really they don't have the kind of infrastructure or institutions that push back. So a lot of falsehoods and a lot of narratives that the left likes become truths to a lot of people in this country. But at the same time, the other side continues to get angrier and angrier about those institutions, media, and doesn't trust them anymore. I saw a poll not recently that I think media trust is below like trust in oil and gas. The only thing trusted less is government. That's I don't know how that affects society in the long run, but it's definitely probably not a good thing.
So now we're at the end of the impeachment. We see Joe Biden basically chewing his teeth and standing there like the old man at a restaurant in Florida waiting for the 4:30 Jell-O. Michael Bloomberg swooping in, hopping over to pick at his carcass and buy the thing. The Obama world and the Clinton world are now having to go support an elitist who would tax the poor in order to force them to his will. And I wonder how this will all turn out.
I don't really know. I mean, here's my view of things. I think that Joe Biden's just a terrible politician, always has been. 1988, he had 0% of the vote in Iowa. In 2008, he had 1% of the vote. He's just been a disaster. He snuck in as a senator in Delaware, small state, and post-Watergate, one of the last candidates who supported Richard Nixon. And since then, he's just made, been wrong basically about every single thing he's ever, taken a position on. So he is a disaster, but I obviously think he's far superior to Bernie Sanders. I don't know now what happens depending in New Hampshire if you have Mayor Pete winning. You know, and then Biden, let's say, wins South Carolina. I just don't know how that all shakes out. I wish I knew. It's hard for me to believe that in the middle of an economic boom, a major political party is going to nominate a socialist. But we're in a weird place right now as a country, so it could happen.
I was arguing that the Democratic National Committee fixed it for Hillary Clinton in 2016. It was the year of insurgency. People who were thinking, forward thinkers, knew that, figured Hillary Clinton was a disaster months before that election. Now I just see, I see the Bernie bros dropping out if Mayor Pete is the default position. And I don't really know how the media will cover Mayor Pete appealing for African-American votes throughout the South and not deal with, will African-Americans be dinged on the intersectionality highway, especially Christian fundamentalists? Will they be mocked by the very people that are the advance guard of the Democratic National Committee in media? I don't know how that's going to turn out.
Yeah. If Mayor Pete wins, he's in a tough spot because rather than moving to the center to appeal to a larger swath of voters, he's probably going to have to try to bring back the Bernie contingent, and that would mean going farther to the left. And if he doesn't do that, obviously that those two populist leftists will not support him. He's going to have to try to get African-American support, which is more moderate, definitely on the social issues front and things like that. So he would be in a tough spot, you know, and if this was a normal election and people thought about the world as they used to, looking at the economy, seeing how things are going, I mean, then Donald Trump should have a runaway election. Obviously, I don't think you can have 1980 again or 72 again. It's just we're too partisan, and it's a cultural thing more than anything else, politics. So, but I still suspect, I mean, I don't like to call elections because everyone comes back at you when you do. But, I mean, if this was a normal election, Donald Trump should run away with it, considering the candidates that he would face, any of them.
What's next for David Harsanyi? Just before you came on, you talked about maybe you might do a podcast with National Review. Do you show up with the editors, you know, and listen to Michael Cook and all those people?
I haven't done that. I'm pretty new here now, so I'm thinking about other kinds of podcasts I might be part of, though I think I might do that one as well. And so we'll see how that goes. And I also write, you know, longer pieces for the magazine. And obviously I have a book out on guns, so I am interested in the politics of that, especially with Democrats trying to ban assault weapons in a number of states right now. So I think those are the things I'll be focusing on.
Yeah, Democrat behavior in Virginia was quite revealing and also comical.
And David, I want to plant a seed with you because it's something I've experienced here in Illinois. At the federal level, obviously marijuana is still a schedule, you know, one class one narcotic. In Illinois, if you have a FOID card and you're concealed carry and you're a gun loving American and want to have a weapon, but you also need medical marijuana to use to whatever your problems are, if you register for that card and then you go to try to buy ammunition for your weapon or trade in a weapon or buy a new weapon, you are denied because your background check comes up on that. I feel like that is kind of a weird cross-section that could be the future of essentially protecting the Second Amendment and legalizing weed. I just loved that thought, and I wanted to plant it at you because as a guy who's well-written and well-versed and talks about guns in this country very much, I'd love to get your thoughts on if they think that it'll ever happen.
God, that's crazy if that's true, because like they argue that there's no problem with pot, that it doesn't, you know, that it's necessary, that it doesn't, you know, make you, you know, a criminal in any way, and then they're going to make you a criminal whenever it's convenient for them. I think obviously that's crazy.
Yeah. Not only make you a criminal, but I know, speaking in the vernacular of the time, deny you your rights, right?
Because an actual right.
A real right.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
And inalienable.
And it all ties back to the fact that the federal, when you have to go through a background check, that is triggered and that pops up as being, oh, you have a medical marijuana card. It means you're a marijuana user. That means, by the according to the federal government, you are ineligible for keeping a weapon.
It's amazing. It's amazing how hypocritical they are. It's like the law in California, where, like a red flag law, where if you go to seek, you know, to a mental hospital to seek help for something, they'll deny you a gun, I think forever now, or maybe it's a year or whatever it is. Yet suicides are half, you know, almost half of gun deaths. Wouldn't you want people who own guns to seek help? You're actually you're disincentivizing them from going to seek help, even though they own a gun. It's just like they don't think this through because they're so... they have such tunnel vision about guns, and, you know, guns are so icky that any way we can try to get people not to have them, you know, we'll move forward on.
I speak as a white kid who brought shotguns to school. Okay. I didn't wear a trench coat. I had them in the trunk, and, I brought shotguns to school because my brother and I would go hunting after first period and the dog was in the car. And things change, right? Things change. David Harsanyi, author of First Freedom, A Ride Through America's Enduring History with a Gun. Go get this book. He's nationally syndicated, writer at the National Review, formerly of The Federalist. Search him out at David Harsanyi. David, it is a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much.
That was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, sir. You know, Jeff, when Governor Toilets came out with his poaching of Iowa, wanted to poach their caucus and bring the first Democratic primary to Illinois, the first thing I thought of was singing. I thought maybe we could sing to all the people in Illinois about Toilets, about Boss Madigan. We could sing like a little song, like Wasted Away in Madiganistan. When the reporters come in to cover the national event. But you know what? When Obama, President Obama, sainted be his name, blessed be his name, peace be upon him, became president, the national media didn't even care that there was a guy named Tony Resco in his background. They didn't care about what he did to climb up through the oily sump of Chicago politics. They just wanted to treat him as something inviolate and special. And I thought singing wouldn't work. It wouldn't attract them. But you know what? Speaking of singing, there's a singer that made news. Kristen McQuarrie, the columnist, editorial board member of the Chicago Tribune, and spiritual sister of the Chicago Way podcast, our friend, is now the... has been named and will become the editor of the editorial pages, the first woman to ever become the editor of the editorial page, if I think I'm not mistaken there.
I can't imagine, yeah, I could imagine a time where there would have been a woman in that position in the history, knowing the history of these smoke-filled rooms with men's in suits and in their briefcases.
No smoke-filled rooms. If there was smoke, it came from cigars.
Right, exactly.
I mean, not cigars. It came from pipes.
Yeah.
Because we sit around in our tweed jackets, you know, how with the patches on, and we talk about, you know, we talk like exactly like the characters in Dial M for Murder talk to each other. Hello, how are you? May I please? Would you have a drink? Would you have a cocktail?
Well, you know, I always say smoke-filled rooms because I had been to the top of the Tribune Tower when we worked there. And the fine white marble that is now tainted yellow with nicotine over years of use, it's probably not there anymore. I'm sure they got rid of it. But the miles and miles of
But see, the Tribune Tower had the editorial board on the fourth floor.
Right.
And that was not non-smoking, but there was the big mahogany table. And now we have our editorial board in the first floor of the Prudential Building, where our new offices are. But really, that's immaterial.
Yes. From State House chick to editor. That's amazing.
Kristen McQuarrie? Yeah, that is just great news.
Nobody's more deserving, really. I mean, she is one of the hardest working journalists. I mean, there are obviously, Tribune is rife with hardworking journalists, but she was always stood out as being one who put a lot of herself into everything she did in you know, all the interviews that she used to do, and still does, to candidates, going out and seeking out pretty much every candidate on the ballot she's talking to and getting their take on and asking them hard questions. Her tenacity is just unmatched.
You want to be a success in an organization, do the jobs that nobody else wants to do. And who wants to sit there and listen to Marie Newman scream at Dan Lipinski for an hour? But she does, you know? Yeah. And all these candidates, and has she called you to ask you to delete her singing? Because we're the only, we're the only people that have Kristen McCrory singing tape, right?
Yeah, there was.
What did we sing? What did she sing?
There were been a couple of them. I'd have to go back and check the records. I'll find them for some interlude in this podcast, I hope, where I'll drop that in. But and that's another thing. She's very talented, that's for sure. She used to, on occasion, she would call in the old Dan and Bruce and Dan show, you know, Proft and them on WLS when we were producing. She'd be listening and call in with a tune every once in a while, or she'd be sitting at her piano and send us something. But yeah, hats off to her. I mean, that's awesome. So good. So good. Such a great thing, especially at a time when you feel, you know, media and journalism has gone so far left and has so many issues of credibility. I think it's a great move. Not that previous editors at the Tribune don't have credibility, but
the Tribune editorial page did not go far left. That's one thing I can say about Bruce Dold, and who's the editor and head and the Pulitzer Prize recipient who would run the editorial page. Jack Fuller before him, my friend, and also another Pulitzer Prize recipient. John McCormick has been doing it for years now, and he is a great guy, very thoughtful. I think I don't really talk a lot about it because it's like, you don't want to talk about what happens in the locker room.
You don't talk about Fight Club.
You don't talk about Fight Club. But we're not fighting there. It is, I thought at first, okay, I got to go to all these meetings, you know, at least 3-4 times a week, take the drive downtown, listen to the Chicago Way podcast, and see where I screwed up and go into a meeting. But the meetings are amazing because we have so many thoughtful people, people of the center, people of the right, people of the left. I always sit to the right of Eric Zorn whenever I can. But John McCormick ran this thing the word collegial comes to mind. People are courteous. There's none of this like Twitter fighting that you see.
Nah.
People actually respect each other's views. And Kristen will, because of John's tenure there, he will seamlessly transition. And he'll still be with us. Maybe now we can get him on the podcast.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
But I heard a rumor that somebody called Kristen to see if she could be on the podcast, you know, on the big day, and she just didn't want to get triggered or something by something. What?
Well, yes, we did invite her to be on to celebrate her. But her response was, and I'm just quoting here, or not quoting, I'm paraphrasing, that she didn't want to be triggered or set off by John in her first act as editor of the editorial board.
She is a very considerate speaker. You know, where I speak from the gut, she speaks, she takes her time, holds back and considers, and she has to do that even more now because she's the voice of an institution. But I still hope we can have her on. I don't think the editorial board boss of the Tribune will ever sing for us, but, you know, we can always hope.
Well, a hope and a prayer on that one.
I love it. Hardly talk to me anymore. When I come home from the Tribune at the end of the day,
I remember when you couldn't wait to love me. You used to hate to leave me.
But now I come home and you tell me to take out the garbage. And the alderman is screaming on the phone, but you say I got to drive the kids to the practice.
I'm not sure I can follow that, but
there's something else I got to talk to you about. I got to go Kim Fox, Jussie Smollett for a second, because I guess if you if you bring up Kim Fox too much or Jussie Smollett, are you racist now? Is that the new rule in journalism in Chicago? Like, oh, come on, Cass. Is that racist?
Yeah,
with that sing-song voice and people talk like that?
Well, no, I don't know.
Savannah Guthrie?
I don't obviously think that's the case. I think really it's really more that you don't like the poor or downtrodden because Kim Fox is a warrior for the downtrodden, apparently, if you look at her policies, because there are too many people who are getting caught up in crimes that are of low level and not important and ruining their lives because they're making the decision to commit crime.
The poor people.
Right.
Yeah, I don't want anybody going to prison for stealing a loaf of bread. This is not France. This is not Jean Valjean.
I don't want people going to prison who have mental issues and are hooked on drugs and are just having their lives ruined by things that are really hard to overcome.
But you know what? If you pull out a gun,
if
you shoot somebody on the L, if you stab them on the L,
if you get a collection of your friends and go rob a store.
A collection of your friends and rob a store, the same one week after week, and steal only $900, and therefore Kim Fox will not, in her social justice warrior mode, not arrest you or have you charged so the cops don't even arrest because they're not going to get a charge. That is a quality of life thing that destroys a city, and that's what Kim Fox is about. She's part of this movement in San Francisco, in New York, in Chicago. I don't know, the George Soros justice warrior thing. And to talk about it, she came over when we had her on the editorial board the other week. She came over, to me after. You know what she said?
Mm-mm.
Hi, John. I said, hey, Kim. She goes, bless you. I said, oh, bless you, Kim. She was laughing because she was caught in some email, one of those emails.
Callback. Oh, God.
Remember those emails when they all came out about the scandal of the Jussie Smollett? She heard something I had written. And she said, oh, bless his heart.
Yeah, one of her comments people had asked her about John Cass's comment or request or whatever, and she said, oh, bless him, bless his heart.
Because you know what? She must be like Nancy Pelosi. She's always, thinking about blessing people. But, because who would use the love of Christ as a weapon against anyone? Nobody. But at the same time, Ro Khan, everybody, there's a little secret. You know this. Jeff Carlin is Ro Khan's producer. So Jeff Khan reaches out to Kim Fox. Am I breaking bad on you?
No, all good.
All right. So Jeff reaches out to Kim Fox. Kim Fox is going to be on.
Yeah.
Kim Fox is going to come on the show. And I'm listening to WGN because, I love listening to that radio station. And in the afternoon, before Ro, Hannah. Anna, yeah. And Anna says she's going to be on. So I was like, cool. I text Jeff, and I'm like, awesome get, man. Kim Fox. It'll be interesting. I'll be listening because I was going to listen because I wanted to hear, Ro is basically a rational human being. He's not one of these.
When it comes to politics.
When it comes to politics, not when he's talking movies.
Not when it comes to lots of other things, but when it comes to politics.
Politics, he has a good sense. And he would ask the question. That's the main thing. That's one thing I like about him. He's going to ask the question. He's not some kiss-ass that won't ask the tough question. So I'm like, I'm all interested because when Kim Fox shows up, I'm thinking, I got four columns to write. This might be one, Let's hear it. And I wait, and I wait, and no Kim Fox. What the hell happened, Jeff Carlin? Did Kim Fox blow you guys off?
Well, I have no proof to confirm or deny such allegations, but I will give you the facts as I know them.
No fact checking here.
Right, real facts. So I had gone through a colleague, if you will, who's connected to her campaign, who set me up with her comms director, who reached out to me and set this up. We were excited. We locked it in on Friday. We've been a week of back and forth trying to figure it out. Friday comes, she says, okay, she's good for Monday. She'll come in at 6, 5:50 that I had asked, so he could be on air at 6:05, that whole thing. And Monday
perfect
comes.
Drive time.
Yeah, absolutely. It's right, a must-listen radio, or tune-in radio, as the bosses will call it. And she was, Kim was going to be in. It was going to be a great thing. We got lots of texts, people asking when it was going to happen, making sure it was going to come in. And then around somewhere in the 4 o'clock hour, about 4:15, 4:30 or so, I got a note from the communications professional in Kim's staff, and it was, you know, just, hey, you know, I'll call you in a sec. I ask you something, and she calls me, and then breaks that there something had happened. There was an issue with the campaign in the morning, and that things were just kind of snowballing, and she just wasn't going to make it work. Wasn't going to be able to come in.
Well, I'm so sorry. The events are beyond my control. Yeah. It sounds like John Malkovich in Dangerous Liaison.
Exactly.
Right? Beyond my control.
Yeah.
Beyond my control.
And obviously things happen. I get that. And we had promoted it, and it was a big deal that we were
on. You're promoting
the station
it on
was
the
talking
air.
About me. Other shows were talking about right. it. We were running promos, all that stuff. So, yeah, that doesn't happen. Well, then, in all fairness, you know, her same woman I was dealing with in her campaign reached out to me, you know, a couple days later, and we're working on other dates. We're back to where we were, you know, a week or so ago. We'll see. I mean, it there is certainly it's not out of the realm of possibility in politics in this state and among many other states, I'm sure, for political guests to lock up a deal, book something, only to hear it, you know, only to have it to say, hey, headline, and people think, oh, look, they're all over the place. So that they get that promotion.
Right.
They get the kick out of being it. The words that they say in the interview itself isn't really as important to them. It's really more about the fact that there's going to be a promo running and tons of people are going to hear, oh, talking to WGN, or she's talking to WBBM, or she's talking to WLS.
Right.
But then in reality that the interviews never really happen. And it's just it's a smoke and mirrors kind of game.
I don't like broadcast interviews of politicians. The only one I do like, I like Lori Lightfoot. I don't know why. Why do I like her? I can't explain. I'm a conservative. She's not, but I just like the woman, and she was here several times, and I like that. I like talking to her. But most of them love broadcast because they can dominate time.
Right.
Rahm was the worst.
Oh, man.
That weasel used to show up on the morning show and just talk about how he likes to eat apples and how great he is.
And
oh, come on.
Swimming in the lake. And,
right?
Yeah.
And they just dominate the time. They talk and talk about nothing and don't let you ask a question. And then, unfortunately, some hosts, not Ro, others, don't want to ask the question because they want them back on.
Right.
So they basically kiss their PC no. You know what a PC no is? The thing you cover, it's your butt, okay? And I don't like that. But in this case, I would say Kim Fox will do the interview. Prediction. When right before her opposition researcher people drop something on one of her opponents who are bothering her, or when she has some great news to tell.
Yeah.
Because she does not want to talk about Juicy,
right.
The French actor, Juicy Smollett.
Yeah, and she doesn't want to talk about how her policies have swung the legal system into a nullified frenzy. That you look at the numbers, and John and I have been talking about this between ourselves off, but it's staggering the in areas, and you said earlier, you know, the shoplifting and the organized shoplifting is hurting the city, and that's certainly true. But it's also reaching out into the suburbs now. You've seen this same game plan now working all over Cook County in at high end stores that are getting ripped off for this very reason. But if you look at the stats, and this is that stats don't lie. I mean, you can fudge polls and use those as you want, but real hard numbers don't lie. On State Street, we've seen a 20% to a 50% increase in retail theft. On Michigan Avenue, same thing. In small pockets, in the higher end stuff over off of Rush Street, we've seen it go up as high as 40%. And that's since Kim's taken the role and implemented her policies. And the question is, you know, how, not necessarily blame for doing it. Okay, I get it. The idea that was why she was elected. These was her progressive policies to reduce the nonviolent crime.
You know, we had the City Journal guy, Rafael Manguel.
Yeah.
And he was talking about decarceration, right? That's this policy throughout the country from the left. Instead of incarceration, get rid of people, get people out of jail.
Right. And that's why she was elected. I get that. And as her policy, okay, sure, that's why we have elections, which I still think is the dumbest thing for a state's attorney, but that's just...
What, to have an election?
To have it be... No, to be an elected, a primaried elected office. I hate that. I hate the idea that it's a Dem versus a Republican.
There are no Republicans.
Well, I know. In Illinois. But there are people on a ballot who are running.
There's a conservative. You're talking to them.
Yeah, you know, I know that. But I hate the idea of a primary, a partisan primary election leading into a state's attorney. It should be that this should be an open election. It should be the best, brightest mind. I don't care about their politics.
Yes.
But it's so political, and I hate that. But my point being that if these policies have gone and they've clearly gone awry to at least a certain extent, how are you fixing it? And she's not coming up with an answer. She doesn't have an answer. Her answer is, I don't need to fix it. It's working.
She likes it. She likes it. And the listeners of the Chicago Way podcast and Jeff Carlin will be happy to know that sooner or later, and probably sooner, you're going to be reading something in somewhere about bail, bond, and the effect of all these policies. The problem is, whether you disagree or agree with Kim Fox, she's not the actual boss of it. The boss is Tony the Boss, Tony Taxwinkle, Sensible Shoes, president of the Cook County Board and chairman of the Cook County Democratic Party. Kim Fox never argued a case, you know, or maybe half of one. She's not a lawyer, really. She's not a felony lawyer, prosecutor. She's a political person. She was Tony Preckwinkle's chief of staff, and Tony put her in. So Tony put her in. Fox is there. Tony puts the defender, the public defender in. That's Tony's person, too. And she tells Tim Evans what to do by cutting and increasing his budget. Tim Evans is the chief judge. So really, this is Tony Preckwinkle's thing.
Yeah.
And what bothers me about journalism is that that's not people don't go to her. Tony, this is your deal. This is the meatloaf is in your lap, you know, with all these people coming out. I've done columns after column about hundreds of people on electronic monitoring who are sex abusers, murderers, attempted murderers, armed robbers, walking around on home monitoring that you can, you know, futz with and just plug it into your car lighter and just drive out and go do a gang bang. And then what happens? The young reporter from, Indiana, who's now in Chicago on TV, she shows up at the house of the dead and the people cry. They say, why did my son die? Why did my son die? Well, you know what? Figure it out. So Kim Fox, you're listening. When Ro Khan calls you, show up. That's all I got to say. I really want to thank David Harsanyi of the National Review for being on the podcast. I really like his work, and I like his thinking, and I read him all the time. And of course, a shout out again, hat tip, whatever, to Kristen McQuarrie. Great voice and great mind. Soon to be the editorial board boss of the Chicago Tribune. And Jeff Carlin, as always, executive producer of the Ro Khan Show on WGN, and my friend. And you know what? A year or two ago, I told you that I took Betty to a movie. I thought it was a love story for Valentine's Day, but it was Manchester by the Sea. I thought it would be a lot. I didn't know it. It was like at the LaGrange Theater. We just walked in. I said, let's go see this. I thought it was like a love story. It wasn't a love story, and it was terrible. It ruined Valentine's Day. We were crying. Then we had an argument, a cry argument. You know how you do with the emotional movies? I don't know if you guys do, but we do. Anyway, so the other night, just before this podcast, we did this podcast, I'm listening to these great McGinty clips, you know, about the politicians in Chicago. And Betty's watching a movie. She goes, "What should I see?" I said, "Why not American Woman?" I saw this on, you know, on HBO On Demand. And she said, "Oh, yeah, it's made by the same person who made Manchester by the Sea. But that's okay. This could be better." So she starts watching it, and I'm working on the podcast and working on my Sunday column. And I'm looking over there, and she's bawling her eyes out. And she stares at me. She turns her head and stares at me. And she says, mouths the words, "Happy Valentine's Day." So I better make some carbonara. That's all I'm saying. This is John Cass, Chicago Tribune editorial board member, and your favorite podcast. Find us on iTunes, subscribe, write good reviews. We're still trying to stay alive. Maybe we can do it with your help. This has been the Chicago Way on WGN+.